Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon to take your calls. If you have questions you'd like to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith, this is a place that you can call and ask. If you have a difference of opinion from the host, this is a place where you can call and say so. So if you have a question or an alternate viewpoint and would like to participate on the program, you'll need a telephone, a phone number, and an open line. Now, right now, we don't have any open lines. Our lines are full, but that changes. That changes as we talk to these callers. They move along, and then a line opens up. So you'll want to have this number available for that time, when that time comes, which it will. Within a few minutes' time, we'll have an open line. You'll want this number, 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Now, among the gazillions of people listening to this radio program right now, there are no doubt some who will find this weekend that either their business or their pleasure takes them to the San Diego area in Southern California. And I just thought I'd let you know, I'll be speaking in San Diego Saturday night, just having an open Bible discussion like we have here on the radio program, and you're welcome to join us if you're going to be in the area and if you'd like to join us. So you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find there the information about this gathering this Saturday night. You'll find the time, the place, a map to get there, and all that remains for you to do is to get yourself a car and drive over there, and we'll see you this Saturday night if you do. All right, so that's the only announcement I have to give before we go to these full phone lines right now. Our first caller today is Ward, calling from Eugene, Oregon. Ward, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. About a week ago, a caller called in about the Pope who had, he said he had heard made Mary the fourth part of the Trinity.
Right.
So a friend of mine went online and looked that up, but we couldn't specifically find that. But we did find some other information that the Pope had declared Mary to be the second Eve, as Jesus is the second Adam, Mary being the second Eve. Well, I looked in my concordance, and there was only four references actually to Eve. And so could you shed some light on that subject? The exaltation
maybe
of Mary and her position and...
Yeah, probably a little bit I can. I've had that conversation with our Catholic friend Tom, who's been calling me for years. This Pope certainly didn't come up with that as an innovation. Roman Catholics have been saying this for years, that Mary is the new Eve. Now, first of all, that's not biblically correct. And secondly, if it was, so what? I mean, it certainly isn't. But I'm not sure what that would tell us about her being, you know, a mediator between God and man or anything like that, because Eve didn't play any of those roles. But the argument is that Eve is like the Ark of the Covenant, and she contained the human race in her, the seed of God, basically, the human race. And she fits into God's plan in the New Testament in the role of Mary, who carried Jesus within her. And they get the idea that we are all Mary's children,
mm-hmm.
I think largely from Revelation 12, where there's a woman who's pregnant and gives birth to a male child. The male child is Christ, and therefore they assume the woman is Mary. I assume the woman is Israel, but they believe Mary is the woman at the beginning of Revelation 12. And at the end of the chapter 12 of Revelation, it says the dragon went forth and made war against the woman and the rest of her seed, those who have the testimony of Jesus and who obey the commands of God. So obviously the rest of her seed are referring to the Christians. Now, if the woman is Mary and the Christians are the rest of her seed apart from Christ, Christ is her seed and then there's the rest, then that would mean that Mary's the mother of all of us because we are the rest of her offspring. And that would mean that just as Eve was the mother of all human beings, Mary is the mother of all Christians. However, this relies on the assumption that the woman in Revelation 12 is Mary, and I don't believe that it is. I don't believe that, as you read about all the things that are said about that woman in Revelation 12, I don't think that they match up with Mary, actually. So I think Israel is the woman, and I think the fact that she's standing in the moon with clothed in the sun with a garland of 12 stars on her head connects her very clearly with an imagery of Genesis chapter 37, a dream that Joseph had, which identifies that as Jacob's family or Israel. So I believe the woman is Israel, and it's Israel that brings Christ in the world. Certainly Mary did so historically, but she was simply part of Israel too. It was through Mary that Israel brought Jesus in, and the woman represents Israel, not Mary. That's how I understand it. Now, Roman Catholics understand it differently. That's how they go with it. Now, the problem here is that if Jesus is the first, the second Adam, how would his wife be represented by his mother?
Right.
I mean, Eve was not the mother of Adam. Eve was the wife of Adam.
Right.
Now, we have in Genesis 2, the very chapter that talks about the creation of Adam and Eve, it says at the end, for this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother, shall cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, this is a reference to Adam and Eve are the prototype for marriage, and forever afterward, marriage would resemble what God created there in the garden. And the woman and the man become one flesh. So Adam and Eve became one flesh in marriage, which is a sexual relationship. Now, Jesus didn't have that kind of relationship with Mary. And therefore, if Jesus is the second Adam, Mary cannot be the second Eve, but who would be?
The bride.
The bride of Christ, exactly. Exactly. The church would be the Eve. If Adam and Eve represent Christ and his bride, then they represent Christ and the church, us. And Mary, who is the mother of Christ, would have no role to play in the imagery because Adam, who's the Christ character in the image, doesn't have a mother. So Mary doesn't even appear in the imagery of the creation of man and woman.
Well, that's interesting. Also, I just thought of the verse where it talks about that the marriage is a picture of Christ and his bride.
That's right. And that's Ephesians 5, and it quotes that verse in Genesis 2:24, which I quoted a moment ago about the woman and the man becoming one flesh.
Right.
Paul quotes it there in Ephesians 5 and says, this is a great mystery. It speaks of Christ and the church. It doesn't say it speaks of Christ and Mary.
Right. Absolutely. Wow. Wow, that sure ties it all together.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, Ward. Well, it's good talking to you.
Thank
God bless you.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Richard from Phoenix, Arizona. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. It was so good to drive down the road, listen to the radio for the first time, and hear your voice, because the first time I ever was introduced to you was on the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Oh, a long time ago.
Yeah, that was like 4 years ago, and I bought your book, Revelation 4 Views. And then I had you heard you on the radio about 2 months ago, and I thought, this is great, because we don't have very many good exegetical Bible teachers on the radio. In fact, I don't know of any right now except yourself.
Well, we've only been on in Phoenix for a few months. This show has been on the air since 1997, but we just added Phoenix to our listening area just in the past few months. So I'm glad you caught us.
Yeah, and I hope it stays, and I'd like to be a contributor someday if I can in the near future. I'd like to do that. As far as today is concerned, I just wanted to call about a previous caller that called in about no more than a week and a half ago. His name was Stephen from Ryan, Ohio. And do you remember him? He was the guy who had a question. He was perplexed about Luke 2:22 and the purification of Mary according to the law of Moses.
I vaguely remember the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll just refresh your memory, and then I wanted to add something to what you said to him. Basically, he was conflicted by this because it said he was reading from a King James Bible, and it says, when the days of her purification, according to the law of Moses, and he was comparing it with other Bibles, like a New American Standard and NIV, mm-hmm. and there, the translation is their purification, not her purification.
Right.
So he was very concerned about that, and you told him, the last thing you told him is that the question isn't resolved by going to different English versions. The question's resolved by seeing which version closely relates or hangs with the original Greek. Generally speaking, you told him that the newer versions are closer to the Greek than the King James was. And so anyway, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to start looking into the Greek. And so I did, and I looked through manuscript evidence, I looked through Greek texts and commentaries, and this is what I came up with, if I could share it with you.
Sure.
Okay. The translation there is the preferred translation by far, because most of the Greek manuscripts, the oldest and the best preserved Greek manuscripts, have there and not her. And that also shows up in the Greek interlinears from which those texts are taken from those manuscripts. So if you're looking at the text for the Textus Receptus text, it says, and when were fulfilled the days of their purification according to the law of Moses. The UBS 4th edition, Nestle Aland 27th edition Greek text, it says, quote, and when were completed the days of the purification of them according to the law of Moses. So the two texts that are coming from the manuscripts in interlinear that a person could just pick up and read would indicate there. And apparently what the problem is that somewhere along the line, somebody that was involved in the King James translation went outside of the Textus Receptus, which, as you're aware, is a text that's used to create the King James. In fact, I don't even think there's another English Bible that the Textus Receptus represents or is represented by that. But anyway, somebody went outside of that and tried to inform the Luke 2:22 text by reading Leviticus chapter 12. Well, in Leviticus chapter 12, it's talking about the woman being unclean, and so they inserted and changed the text from there to her based on a reading of Leviticus chapter 12. But I don't believe that that's a legitimate thing to do hermeneutically, because you should not be allowed to be pulling a text and informing the text, because the Luke passage, like all other texts, has its own internal evidence, and to inform it by another text, unless of course the Luke text was unclear and ambiguous or something like that, then you could go to another parallel passage, or you could go to extra biblical sources, but you see the problem there, that it would not be correct to pull it and hijack it from Leviticus 12 and insert her into a Greek manuscript that all the attestations of it is there. Most all of them are there and not her.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, your methodology is correct, and to take information from Leviticus, and therefore to assume that Luke meant to say something differently than what the manuscripts have him saying, is definitely a bad policy.
Yeah, I'm glad you see it that way, because I see that happen a lot. But another thing, too, they talked about, I looked at some commentaries, and also the Greek grammar would tend to support there as well. According to Fitzmyer, Friedrich Godet, Leon Morris, and others, it requires that that there have a correlation to they. So he says, for example, he says that it must refer to Joseph and Mary, because the pronoun there has a grammatical connection to the verb they, that is Jesus' parents. If it was her, it seems to me it'd be more likely to say that she brought Jesus up to the temple. But the fact that it says they brought him up, there seems to be a connection in the clause between there and they, a grammatical connection that's required. Fritzmeyer says this. He says, quote, the pronoun there must be understood to refer to Joseph and Mary because of the main verb, anagegong, they, i.e. his parents, brought him up, close quote, that is, to Jerusalem.
That's a good argument.
Yeah. So I looked into that. Let's see if there's anything else. It brings up an issue, and that is, okay, well, if it's referring to there, then how can that does bring up a conflict, and that is, generally speaking, in the Old Testament, a man or the child would not be considered unclean. Leviticus doesn't make any provisions, and neither does anywhere in the Old Testament make any provision for a child to be purified, or for the man who has touched an unclean woman who's given birth to be purified. So what does it mean when it means there and it's referring to Joseph and Mary? And what I came up with, what I read, is that it could refer to Joseph because he's the head of the family and they're married. And so he's going to be providing the sacrifice, the payment for the sacrifice that's going to be given for Mary. And it only speaks of one sacrifice in the Luke passage. It doesn't speak of more than one sacrifice. So one person, that is Mary, offered a sacrifice, not Joseph, and certainly Joseph and Jesus wouldn't be a part of being impure. It's sort of like what we could say, of somebody who is giving birth, a man and a woman. You could say, well, they're going to have a baby. Well, you know, the man's not going to have
well,
a baby,
even
the woman's.
Perhaps even more simply than that, since the woman was considered to be unclean for 40 days after she had a baby, any contact with her, and it'd be hard for a husband not to have contact with his wife during that period of time. I mean, even just helping her stand up or do anything else to have contact with her, to sit on the same bed, to touch her in any way, that would render him unclean according to the laws. Where you touch something unclean, you're unclean. So there's a sense in which, although the book of Leviticus may not speak specifically of the purification of the husband after that, he presumably would be subject to uncleanness simply by his near intimate contact with her. But,
well, there's definitely people who agree with you on that point. There's scholars who brought up that issue. Is it possible that Joseph was considered to be unclean, but yet he wasn't required to bring a sacrifice, and that's why Luke only speaks of one sacrifice, not two?
Well, right. Yeah, generally speaking, in the laws of uncleanness, you don't have to bring a sacrifice, but in the case of a childbirth, they did. And that's what Leviticus 12 talks about. The woman, at the end of her purification, or 40 days, brings the sacrifice. But Joseph, if he had simply been unclean by touching a leper or touching his wife when she was unclean or by, going to a funeral or some other way, his period of uncleanness would not be ended with a sacrifice. Generally speaking, Jews didn't have to offer a sacrifice to purify themselves after a period of ceremonial uncleanness. It was just like you'd go a week being unclean and then you'd wash your clothes and take a bath and you were okay again. So the offering of the sacrifice would only be relevant to the woman necessarily, but it would still be a time of purification that would have impact on the whole family, since baby and husband would have contact with her.
Are you aware of any Old Testament passages where it talks about, because you have a lot of situations where it talks about a man or a woman being around, say, a corpse or dead body or a leper or something like that would render them to be unclean for a period of time. So do you see of any place in the Old Testament where a man could be around a woman who was discharging impurities for a period of time and be considered unclean because he's around her? Not in Leviticus 12, but anywhere else.
Well, yes. Well, depends on how much contact he had with her. We would have to assume that a woman right after she has a baby needs some physical help around the house and things like that. And therefore, a husband, in the course of life, would probably have contact with her. Now, the law does say that if a man, for example, if a woman is having her menstrual period, and a man or anyone else sits on a bed that she sat on, well, then he's unclean, just because the bed was unclean, and then he's unclean. Any physical contact with the clothing, with the bed, or with the person of somebody who's unclean transmits uncleanness, general uncleanness. And so I would imagine it'd be a very unusual situation where a woman had a baby and in the 40 days following that she was unclean, that her husband had no contact with her or anything she touched. In fact, he'd have to probably take the baby from her hands on occasions. And, it's just hard to imagine any family life where the husband wouldn't have that kind of contact. Therefore, uncleanness, ceremonial uncleanness, would almost have to be contracted unless extreme pains were made to avoid it. Now remember, uncleanness in the Old Testament is not sin. It's a
right.
It's a ritualistic symbolic condition. It's a teaching device. It's not an area where anyone has any culpability. If you got leprosy, you'd be unclean, but you wouldn't be guilty of anything. A woman has a baby, she's unclean. A woman has her period, she's unclean, but she's not guilty of anything. There's no guilt associated with uncleanness. Uncleanness in the Old Testament is simply a ritual state that's symbolic of something spiritual, which is never really brought out in the Old Testament, but some actual teaching in the New Testament does exist. For example, unclean animals represent Gentiles in the New Testament, as we see from Peter's vision he had on the rooftop in Joppa or even some other kind of situations. But brother, we've been talking a good portion of the program, and this subject, interesting as it may be to a few of us, probably doesn't interest everybody as much. I've had all these details.
You've got that right. Absolutely.
And my lines are full.
Talking to you. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay, Richard. Thanks for your call.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Appreciate that information. All right. Ray from Las Vegas, Nevada is next. Ray, thank you for waiting. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, good afternoon, Steve. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you.
Good. Hey, I'm in a little bit of a thought struggle. You know, I finished a bachelor's theology. I'm beginning working on a master's.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hold any paperwork with any congregation or group like that. But I've been studying a lot about the church growth. I've been through a lot of different books, you know, a lot of people have their own theory on where to put the pews, how many people in the parking lot, you know, to park the car, all this nonsense. Some may not think it's nonsense.
Okay.
But I've come to an understanding, and it has to do with the church today, or the people, the Christians today. And I've run into this almost on a daily basis. I've run into people that are Christians, practicing Christians, but yet they don't want, I guess the term is, you know, they love Jesus, but they don't love the church. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm reading a book now by a guy named Alan Hirsch, called The Forgotten Ways. And I'm only 100 pages into it, but he brought up something interesting. He kind of put together a timeline on how the church grew before Constantine, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's massive growth. Then he put together the Constantine kind of era, which brought about hierarchy, church buildings, you know, and sacraments, all these kind of things.
Creedalism.
And now, mm-hmm. Exactly. And now he's putting this into I think I agree with him. But he's putting us into a age now where the Constantine Church, if you would, era has ended. The way that we do churches, and it's not effective. I mean, I've done a lot of study. You know, the church like we did church 20, 30 years ago, it's just not growing. You know, it's not effective. And he's making mention of groups, cell groups, and things like that. And I'm a little weary about cell groups. I'm just a year or two younger than you, and I remember the coffee houses that were around, you know, and the Jesus movements and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess my it's not really a because I believe God's calling me that way for sure.
Into church ministry? You mean?
Yes, but not into the church like you see today.
Okay, into more organic church or something
exactly.
else?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I guess my. It's not a fear, it's a concern. You know, as I progress into this master's program, my concern is that it's easier and easier and easier to be detached from that and more attached into the Constantine church, the legalistic type of
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know. I mean, have you heard of this guy, Alan Hirsch, in any of his writings?
Well, I don't remember his name off the top of my head. I actually do read a number of church historians and also some people, you know, who are advocating organic churches of various kinds. So, I mean, actually his name might even be, you know, something I've heard and just has
right.
skipped my mind. But I don't know what exactly he's advocating, but I agree that the church went through a very strange transmogrification when Constantine became a Christian, because it merged church and state in a very significant way and institutionalized church even more than it had been previously. And if he's saying, well, we're past that point now, he may be right. Institutional church still exists, and some institutional churches are really big too. But mm-hmm. it's not very common that you find a large institutional church that's making a tremendous impact for the kingdom of God on the society around them. And I'm sure I may be missing some cases I've never heard of. I know that institutional churches can make an impact, but, you know, it doesn't seem like the early church. And there's a lot of people who have left the institutional churches, and they are looking for something else. Now, you are studying for ministry, and it sounds to me like you're conflicted over whether you really want to get a master's degree in church ministry if what they're going to be teaching you is a model of church that's really on the way out and isn't effective. Is that what you're asking?
Well, no, I'm not getting a master's in ministry. Well, it's a master's in theology.
Okay.
But I am called, and I do, I am called to teach, and I do teach small groups. You know, a lot of times I enjoy it. Sometimes I don't enjoy it, you know. So I think, I guess my point is I'm not so sure that in this calling that my theology is as important as the concept of having a church, and I don't even want to use the word church, but having a group of Christians, a gathering that I guess, you know, people my age would call a church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is more important that the gathering or church or whatever that you're involved in has real church life than the most perfect theology. Now, I'm not against good theology. I love good theology. I'm a great student of theology, and I love to think that my theology is good, and if it's not, that I will want to correct it because I want my theology to be as perfect as it can be. But that's secondary. Having perfect theology is secondary to having real Christian life, and that Christian life is corporate, not just me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that, and that's where I'm at. So, you know, I mean, I'm at peace with that. But my other concern, God is really calling me to do that. I there's no doubt. I mean, I'm 57, 58 years old, and I know what God is asking me to do. But I'm still a little concerned about chaos, and I say that in the terms, you know, I come out of, you come out of a very pious or proper kind of a thing, and you're into a more type of thing that was with the coffee houses in the 70s and the 60s.
You mean the chaos of something that's not organized and institutionalized, something that's more free and unstructured. Okay, well, I have some thoughts about that. Perhaps mine should not be considered to be the last word on the subject, but I've definitely have given that a lot of thought. And I think the problem is, first of all, there was some chaos in the early church, too. Let's put it, I mean, if you read 1 Corinthians chapter, well, the whole book of 1 Corinthians, you get the impression there was a certain amount of chaos in the church there because of the carnality of the people in it. I think that we have an even higher percentage of carnal Christians in the church today than they had back then. I mean, Corinth, maybe the whole church was carnal, as Paul said, but I think most Christians in the early days had the Spirit of God and, of course, were following Jesus in a way that has been long forgotten by the church through the years of institutionalization. Remember, when the church was institutionalized and became more or less wedded with the Roman Empire, that meant that everybody who was born in the Roman Empire was born to be part of the church and therefore was baptized at birth. Now, infant baptism had already been begun before Constantine's time, at least by the end of the second century or the early third century. Infant baptism had become a common practice in the church, but it was only practiced on the children of Christians. That is to say, Christians baptized their babies to include them in the covenant. But once the whole Roman Empire became supposedly Christian, then everyone who was born in the empire was baptized. And that being so, I mean, there would be some exceptions. There'd be some pagans, some barbarians or whatever that weren't baptized. But for the most part, just being a mainstream Roman person, Christian or not, meant that you were baptized, and therefore you were part of the church, and therefore the church became not so much a fellowship of Christians as, the state religion of a particular continent. And with that being the case, of course, the church began to fill up with people who really had no conversion, had no commitment to Jesus as Lord in their daily life. had never repented of their sins. They were just born baptized, you know, and so they were in the church. Now, that is very different. And although there have been changes, and there are Protestant churches now that we don't have state churches here in this part of the world, and hopefully the state church is a thing of the past globally. We'll see. But there still is the mentality that you can be a part of the church without being converted. Now, even churches that believe that you must be converted to be a true member of the church, they still leave the church doors wide open for people who aren't Christians because they want the church to be an evangelistic opportunity for the unbelieving neighbors. They want Christians to invite their non-Christian friends to church so the preacher can evangelize them, and then they can grow their church with new members. But that ends up meaning that when you go to any given church, a certain percentage of those people are real Christians. Another percentage are, you know, I guess they think themselves to be Christians, but they may not fully understand what is involved in being a real Christian. And then another percentage of people, and a fairly large one it may be, are not even converted yet. So you don't, now when you try to have a meeting with those kind of people, you can't count on the idea that everyone's being led by the Holy Spirit, because not everyone's even converted. And therefore, physical structure, organizational structure imposed upon it, seems to be the only thing to keep it from going chaotic. Remember, the chaotic church in the New Testament that we read about is the Corinthian church, and it was because they were all carnal. They weren't spiritual. But if you have a church made up of spiritual people, then the Holy Spirit can keep order. God is not a God of confusion, but of order. And I believe that God, if he's leading people, will lead them into such order as he wishes them to have, though it might not look like an organization when they do, but it won't be chaotic. In my experience, I have meetings lots of places with Christians, and they're not a highly structured order to it, you know, but they're orderly enough because people are not disruptive. And I think that if you have preached the gospel in such a way that people understand what it means to really be converted, to be a Christian, and only those who are Christians are in the church, because the church is, after all, the body of Christ and should only be made up of Christians, then this matter of chaos would not be as much a problem. But I think we still have yet to outgrow the idea which may have begun with Constantine that a person can be a part of the church even if they've never really been converted, and or if they have been maybe kind of half converted under a watered down gospel presentation. People who've kind of made some kind of decision they want to be a Christian, but they've never really understood what they're committing to. After all, there's tons of churches out there that don't even teach the Lordship of Christ, and they teach you can become a Christian by raising your hand and saying a sinner's prayer. Of course, the Bible teaches no such thing as that, but because of that, a whole bunch of people have become part of the church. They're half converted because they've decided they want to be Christians on those terms, but they're not real converts. They've never surrendered to Jesus Christ. They haven't taken up their cross to follow him. Once you find real converts who really do have the Spirit of God, they are led by the Spirit of God. As many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the children of God, Paul said. And I think it's that leading of the Spirit of God that renders the institutional structures unnecessary in order to avoid chaos. But if you have a bunch of carnality and unconverted people, there's going to be chaos unless you've got structure. I'm sorry, Ray, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, one last thing. Yeah, he does give an example in the book. I guess he was, the writer was a part of the Church of Christ, and they broke away. They started this thing, and they actually started it in they bought a lounge is what they did. And he gives this as it was a failure. It ended up failing because of business decisions, but they bought a lounge. And they would have meetings or gatherings, and, you know, people would be down there. He's very, I don't know if liberal is not the right word, but, you know, he makes mention people would come, they would eat, they would have a drink or two, they would share Christ, these kind of things, you know. But he says, you know, but in the back room, you know, he had drug deals going on with a group, you know, and
Wait a minute. The church that he had going was dealing drugs?
Well, no. He was going to a church. He called it the mother. He calls it, and I'm only 100 pages into the book. Uh-huh. Okay, so you know, I mean, But he calls it the Mother Church. They started this group. And he says the church was really divided into three. They decided that it was time for outreach, that they wanted to start something where the people were rather than just the church, because the church was not growing. A third of the church agreed with it, a third didn't care, and a third protested. But, you know, of the Mother Church kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they bought this lounge. What he did is he looked around.
Ray, I'm going to jump in here, only because we've been talking a long time, and I've got people who've been waiting a half hour to get on the show. What's the name of the book? If people are interested in knowing all these things you're about to tell us, they could get it from the book, I presume, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's called The Forgotten Ways by Alan Hirsch.
Okay, The Forgotten Ways by Alan Hirsch, and you're more or less finding them agreeable, or just it's rattling your cage.
No, I'm kind of right in the middle. Parts of it I agree with. The whole thing of where the church is today, or what the church is not today, that kind of thing.
Well, lots of people are observing that the church has come to a kind of unhealthy place, and there's a lot of books coming out by people who have suggestions about how church can become more organic. I don't know. Have you ever heard my lecture series called Some Assembly Required?
I read through some of it online, or listened to some of it.
It's a lecture series, MP3s, at my website. It's called Some Assembly Required. And it goes into these same things. It goes into the history of the church, how the church changed throughout time, and my own suggestions, some of them, as to how to go back to a more first century church. But anyone, including myself, who makes suggestions about how to go back to a New Testament style church, really, you have to take them with a grain of salt, and you have to compare what they say with Scripture and make sure that you're not just buying into somebody's newfangled ideas about what old-time Christianity was.
Well,
all right,
Ray. You've got other callers, so
I do.
Thank you for the time.
All right. Thanks for your call.
All right. Bye-bye.
God bless. Sharon from Bellevue, Washington, thank you for waiting so long, and welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
You'll need to turn off your radio, though, because I can hear myself delayed.
We're making up really badly.
Could you turn your radio off?
All right. Bear with me here a moment.
Okay.
I can't hear you on the phone.
You can't?
No, it's very broken up. I can barely hear you, but I was told that you could hear me.
I can, yes.
Okay, great. You're better now that you're speaking to me directly, because I couldn't hear on the phone earlier. That's why I was listening on the radio. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I have a pretty straight-ahead, simple question for you as I'm going through the New Testament, and Jesus refers to himself repeatedly as the Son of Man. And what I'm confused about is it the Son of God that is made in man form? I'd just like to hear what your explanation is about it, Steve, if you would.
Okay, and I'm going to hang up so you can listen to the radio.
That's all I'm going to hang up.
Yeah, I can't listen to your radio and you at the same time because it's offset by several seconds and it's very confusing. Okay, so why did Jesus call himself the Son of Man? There are different theories about that. Most scholars seem to take the view that Jesus was referring to a term that the intertestamental writers, that is the rabbis, just prior to Jesus' own lifetime, had spoken of. There's some kind of a heroic figure called the Son of Man, and they take this probably from Daniel chapter 7, around verse 13, where it says, I saw one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and he received a kingdom, and so forth. There's this one reference in the Old Testament to one like a Son of Man, which is a reference to Christ or to his kingdom. And then the rabbis had come up with this Son of Man character, which was perhaps overlapped their idea of the Messiah. And so many scholars feel that Jesus was borrowing the language from them and referring to himself as that rabbinic character called the Son of Man, or that he was referring to himself as the Son of Man in Daniel 7:13. Now, the problem here, of course, is that I'm always reluctant to think that Jesus was making reference to something the rabbis taught and affirming it, because Jesus had so much, he was so much at odds with the rabbis, and he urged his disciples, beware of the teaching of the rabbis, of the scribes and Pharisees. They were the rabbis. And, you know, he said there, it's like leaven. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is their doctrine, their teaching. And he indicated that the traditions of the rabbis were often at odds with the word of God, and he rebuked them for that sometimes too. So, in other words, I have trouble believing that Jesus was borrowing the term from the rabbis. Now, most evangelicals would say he was borrowing it from Daniel 7, where Daniel sees one like a son of man. And it may be that the language is taken from that, although the language is different. Daniel didn't see the son of man. He saw one like a son of man. Now, a son of man is simply a human. And if you'll do a concordance study of the term son of man in the Old Testament, you'll find the term occurs hundreds of times, I think, at least scores of times, but not with reference to Christ or to the Messiah, but just with reference to man. The word son of man, the term son of man, is simply a Hebraism that means a man. And only one time that I know of does it refer to an allusion to Christ, and that's in Daniel 7:13. But there, it's not that a character is called the son of man, but rather Daniel sees one like a son of man. And this is in a context of a chapter where he has previously seen four empires rise. One was like a lion, one was like a bear, one was like a leopard, and one was another kind of ferocious creature. And then he sees one like a human, a son of man. And these are empires. And I believe the son of man is personified there. I think he's, if we identify the son of man as any individual, it would be Christ. Though it may well be that one like a son of man is a kingdom, just like one like a lion was a kingdom, and one like a bear was a kingdom. That is to say, Christ's kingdom. I have no objection to making Christ out to be the son of man in Daniel 7:13, but the language of it doesn't necessarily make that the easiest thing. I believe it is referring to Christ's kingdom, headed up by Christ, so, you know, no problem there. The point is here, that the term the Son of Man, which Jesus used probably, I think, 90 times in the Gospels, 70 or 90, I forget the total number, but a great number of times. It was definitely the favorite term that Jesus used in speaking about himself. That term is not, you know, the equivalent of the term as it appears in Daniel. But it is the equivalent of scores of occurrences of the term in the Old Testament, where it just means a man or a mere man or a real human, a descendant of Adam. And when Jesus called himself the Son of Man, he seems to have been creating a title for himself that he preferred to use, which connected him with the human race, made him a human, made him out to be a human. Now, he did call himself the Son of God also. The term Son of God is not used anywhere near as often by Christ as the term Son of Man, but Jesus was the Son of Man and the Son of God, and he's also the Son of David. There's lots of terms that are used for him, but Jesus seemed to refer to himself as the Son of Man more than any other term, and I, you know, we can go along with what most of the scholars say and say he was picking up a rabbinic term and applying it to himself, or we could suggest that he's simply emphasizing his humanness. Now, to emphasize his humanness is a tremendous thing when you realize he's God, or the Son of God, because, as it says in Philippians chapter 2, that he exists in the form of God, but he emptied himself and took on himself the form of a servant, of a man. And he did become a human being, which is a great humbling of himself. And he may have been referring to this humbling when he referred to himself as the Son of Man, that he was, in fact, God who had become a real man. He had really tapped into the human race, become part of us, come through the family lines of Adam and Abraham and David. And so the emphasis, if the term Son of Man on the lips of Jesus has the significance that the same term has in the Old Testament, would simply be an emphasis on him being a man, a human. And of course, that might seem like a strange thing for someone to call himself, since everybody you meet is a human. Yeah, but not everybody you meet is God, having become a human. And that could be the subtext for the terminology. Otherwise, I'm afraid I don't know what his reason was for using the term. One thing you will find, though, is that as you do a study of the term Son of Man in the Old Testament, it always refers to a mere man or a human being. It's just another term for man. And so Jesus certainly identified himself as a son of Adam, a mere man like ourselves. A mere man in one respect, but in one respect, of course, not mere at all, because he was God who had become a man. This is what Paul kind of underscores in Romans chapter 1 at the beginning, where he says that the gospel that he preaches, he said, is about God's Son, Jesus Christ, who was a son of David according to the flesh, but declared to be the Son of God with power through the resurrection from the dead. The fact that he was a son of David according to the flesh, it says in Romans 1:3, but declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection of the dead, in the next verse, makes it clear that Jesus was both. He was a human being from the line of David, and he was also God from heaven, or the Son of God. And those two things were mixed together in him. This was a mystery that the Pharisees did not really understand, because Jesus said, well, whose son is the Messiah? And they said, it's going to be David's son. And Jesus said, well, then why did David call him Lord? And Jesus quotes Psalm 110, verse 1, where David said, the Lord, Yahweh, said to my Lord, the Messiah, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. So Jesus said, why did David call the Messiah his Lord if he's his son? Of course, the answer, which was not given in that passage, is that the Messiah is David's son. He is a human being, but more than that, he's the Son of God. And Jesus seemed to emphasize in his self-references the fact that he was a human more often than he referred to himself as the Son of God. And why that was an important thing for him, I guess, is something that many speculations could be made about. To my mind, it seems to me simply an emphasis on his humility, on that though he existed as the form of God, he really did become a real son of man, a real human being. Dave from Placerville, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Hey, Hi. Thanks for your mystery, man. Really appreciate your website, especially. It's through the years, it's really helped me and a lot of Christians and non-Christians alike. My question is with regard to Satan, and why the Lord has allowed he and his minions to be around for so long. And if we as human beings are as bad, left to our own pride and evil desires, you know, we have the world, we have the flesh, and we have Satan and his minions pulling on us. Why does God still allow Satan so great an influence after the cross of Christ? I know that he's bound, Satan at the cross, and you know, I know he puts restraints on him, the Bible says, and he tells the Roman believers, I think it's in Romans 16, that that the God of peace will crush him under their feet, I believe it says shortly. Mm-hmm. But what is the biblical reason? I'm not sure I've ever heard a biblically reasoned answer as to why God allows Satan and his demons to continue to add fuel to the scourge of humanity and our sin and sinfulness. And I realize that somehow it's for the Lord's glory. Mm-hmm. But I've never heard a biblically reasoned answer for that.
From the time of the Garden of Eden until that time, which is still future, when Satan is actually destroyed in the lake of fire, is the period of time of man's probation. It's the period of time of man's being tested. Now, it's true that that period of time was interrupted by Jesus coming and dying and rising again and changing a great deal. For one thing, giving us light so that we don't have to be deceived by the darkness that Satan brings. Jesus brought truth so we don't have to follow lies. He actually gave us power over sin so that we don't have to succumb to the influence of Satan to tempt us to sin. In other words, Jesus gave great resources to Christians. But he did not take away from Christians or from others the obligation to face testing and to remain faithful under testing. And I believe that when we see Adam and Eve meeting Satan or meeting the serpent for the first time, we see the first case of humans being tested to see if they will be loyal to God or not. Satan is the tempter, the tester. Now, I believe that every human being afterward has had to face temptation or testing also. And that's what this life, in one way, this life is our test. Seen another way, it's our education, and it we're brought up through the conflict. We become strong in battle. So there's a battle that we fight. So we learn, and we grow, and we're strengthened through the conflict. But we're also being tested by it. I think God accomplishes a great deal through this interaction between us and Satan. But the time will come when all the testing is over. For one thing, every person who dies, and everyone does, the testing is over for them at that point. But the time will even come when the test period, the probation period for mankind, will end, I believe, when Jesus comes back and he destroys the devil. And that the devil actually functions as the tester in this system. And the reason that we have to be tested is because we're qualifying or disqualifying for the high calling of God in Christ Jesus, which is to rule the universe with Jesus, to reign with Christ. Now, you don't want to give that kind of power to someone who hasn't been tested and whose loyalty is not established. And so this lifetime, every one of us gets one lifetime, short or long, to either prove ourselves loyal to God or prove ourselves disloyal to God. And Satan is there to induce us to be disloyal day by day. And God's word, God's spirit, and other resources God gives us, the church and so forth, are there to help to prevent us from being deceived and to encourage our loyalty to God. So this is the warfare that's going on. And at the end of our life, the testing is done for us. And we get to go and, have whatever reward our final exam has earned us. And so I think Satan has an actual positive role this way. He's not a good guy. He's a bad guy. But God has use for him. And if God didn't have use for him, he wouldn't tolerate him.
Well, do you give any credence to the fact that the flesh and the world, I mean, I don't want to get into whether Adam and Eve would have taken that bite or not without Satan there. I think they might have. But it just seems like three things stacked against us, and the fact that Satan is almost rewarded, it seems, in some weird way with millennia of life. I mean, he's lived for thousands and thousands of years, and he's the most evil, you know. I think we just...
Well, no, he's not rewarded. He's not rewarded. He's just...
No, it seems that way.
He's being used. He's being utilized. See, if I was running a university and I'm trying to train people to be rulers of the world and I had the coursework laid out, I would have certain times of testing. There'd have to be exams at certain times for them to graduate. And I would have to have somebody appointed to, administer the tests. And Satan is the one who administers the tests. He's the examiner. He's the tempter. And so it's not that Satan is being given a privilege. It's that Satan is being used. He's being utilized. Now, is Satan happy to be used by God? No, I doubt it. He's evil. I don't think he has any sentiments favorable toward God. But that doesn't mean God can't use him. The Bible indicates that God has created all things and can use all things for his purpose. And Deuteronomy 13, it talks about false prophets coming to deceive Israel, and it says, don't follow them because the Lord your God is testing you to see if you love the Lord your God or not. So here's a false prophet, no doubt, following Satan rather than God, trying to lead the people away. And it says, Moses says, this is God testing you to see if you're going to be loyal or not. So God makes use, even of false prophets, to test his people. He gives us the truth. The devil gives us the lies, and we decide whether we're going to believe God or the devil. And this is the way we decide, determines whether we pass or fail. Anyway, I'm afraid we're out of time for the program. I hope that may bring a little bit of light to an otherwise obscure subject. And my apologies to those who are not able to get on the program because we've run out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday. We are listener supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website and donate from there. The website has much free material, nothing for sale, but you can also donate if you want. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. God bless you.